His father died Wednesday. What's he been up to in London, apart from burying him? Brotherhood continued. I assumed he'd be dropping in at head office. He never did. He didn't ring, he didn't visit. Then probably he was busy. Did he have any plans for London? Anything he told you of? He said that he'd go and see Tom at school. Well, he did that. He went. Anything else? Friends? Dates? Women? She was suddenly very tired of him. He was burying his father and tidying up Jack. The whole visit was one long date. If you'd had a father and he died, you'd know how it was. Did he phone you from London? No. Steady, Mary. Think now, that's 5 days already. No, he didn't. Of course he didn't. Would he usually? If he can use the office phone, yes. And if he can't? She thought for him. She really tried. She had been thinking for so long. Yes, she conceded. He'd phone. He likes to know we're all right all the time. He's a worrier. I suppose that's why I went off with such a bang when he didn't show up. I think I was worried already. Lumsden was stalking round the room in his stockinged feet, pretending to admire Mary's watercolours of Greece. You're so, so talented, he marvelled, his face pressed against a view of Plomari. Did you go to art school or simply do it? She ignored him. So did Brotherhood. It was a tacit bond between them. The only decent diplomat is a deaf Trappist, Jack liked to say. Mary was beginning to agree. Where's the servant? Said Brotherhood. You told me to get rid of her, on the phone, when I rang. She smell a rat? I don't think so. It mustn't get out, Mary. We've got to sit on it as long as we possibly can. You know that, don't you? I guessed. There's his Joes to think of, there's everything to think of. Far more than you can know. London's stiff with theories and begging for time. You're quite sure Lederer hasn't phoned? Jesus, she said. His eye fell on Harry, who was unpacking his clever boxes. They were grey-green and possessed no apparent controls. You can tell the servant they're transformers, he said. Umformer, Lumsden piped helpfully from the wings. Transformer is Umformer. Die kleinen Büchsen sind Umformer. Once again, they ignored him. Jack's German was almost as good as Magnus's, and about 300 times better than Lumsden's. When she'd you back? Brotherhood asked. Who? Your servant, for God's sake. Tomorrow lunchtime. Be a good girl and see if you can get her to stay away a couple more days. At this hour? At any bloody hour. Do it. She went to the kitchen and phoned Frau Bauer's mother in Salzburg. Sorry about the outrageous hour, but with a death that's how it goes, she said. Herr Pym is remaining in London for a few days, she said. Why don't you take advantage of Herr Pym's absence and have a nice rest, she said. When she came back, it was Lumsden's turn to say his piece. She got his drift immediately, and after that she deliberately stopped hearing him. Just to fill in any awkward blanks, Mary, so that we're all speaking the same language. Mary, while Nigel is still closeted with Ambass, in any case, which, God forbid, the odious press gets onto it before it's all cleared up, Mary. Lumsden had a cliché for every occasion, and a reputation for being nimble-minded. Anyway, that's the route Ambass would like us all to go, he ended, using the very latest in daring jargon. Not unless we're asked, naturally, but if we are. And Mary, he sends terrific love. He's with you all the way. And with Magnus, too, naturally. Terrific condolences, all that. Just nothing to Lederer's crowd, said Brotherhood. Nothing to anyone. But for God's sake, nothing to Lederer. There's no disappearance, nothing abnormal. He's gone back to London to bury his father. He's staying on for talks at head office. End of message. It's the same route I've been going already, Mary said, appealing to Brotherhood, as if Lumsden didn't exist. It's just that Magnus didn't apply for compassionate leave before taking it. Yes, well, now I think that's the part Ambass wants us not to say, if you don't mind, said Lumsden, showing the steel. So I think we won't, please. Brotherhood squared to him. Mary was family. Nobody messed her around in front of Brotherhood, least of all some over-educated flunky from the Foreign Office. "You've done your job," said Brotherhood. "Fade away, will you? Now." Lumsden left the way he had come, but faster. Brotherhood turned back to Mary. They were alone. He was as broad as an old blockhouse, and, when he wanted to be, as rough. His white forelock had fallen across his brow. He put his hands on her hips, the way he used to, and drew her into him. "God damn it, Mary," he said, as he held her. "Magnus is my best boy. What the devil have you done with him?" From upstairs she heard the squeak of casters and another loud thud. "It's the bow-fronted chest of drawers. No, it's our bed. Georgie and Fergus are taking a look round." The desk was in the old servant's room next to the kitchen, a sprawling, spidery half-cellar to which no servant had been consigned for 40 years. Near the window among Mary's pot-plants stood her easel and watercolours. Against the wall, the old black-and-white television and the agonising sofa for watching it. "There's nothing like a little discomfort," Magnus liked to say primly, "for deciding whether a programme is worth its salt." In an alcove under lanes of piping stood the ping-pong table where Mary did her bookbinding, and on it lay her hides and buckram, and glues and clamps and threads, and marbled endpapers, and powdering knives, and the bricks in Magnus's old socks that she used instead of lead weights, and the wrecked volume she had bought for a few shillings at the flea market. Beside it, next to the defunct boiler, stood the desk, the great crazy Habsburg desk, bought for a song at a sale in Graz, sawn up to get it through the door, and glued together again, all by clever Magnus. Brotherhood pulled at the drawers. "Key?" Magnus must have taken it. Brotherhood lifted his head.
"Harry!"
Harry kept his lockpicks on a chain, the way other men keep keys, and held his breath to help him listen while he probed. "Does he do all his homework here, or is there somewhere else?" "Daddy left him his old campaign table. Sometimes he uses that." "Where is it?"
"Upstairs."
"Where upstairs?"
"Tom's room."
"Keeps his documents there too, does he? Firm's paper?"
"I don't think so. I don't know where."
Harry walked out, smiling, with his head down. Brotherhood pulled open a drawer.
"That's for the book he was writing," she said, as he extracted a meagre file.
"Magnus keeps everything inside something. Everything must wear a disguise in order to be real." "Is it, though?" He was pulling on his glasses, one red ear at a time.
"He knows about the novel, too," she thought, watching him. "He's not even pretending to be surprised." "Yes." "And you can put his bloody papers back where you got them from," she thought. She did not like how cold he had become. How hard.
"Gave up his sketching, did he? I thought you two were into that together."
"It didn't satisfy him. He decided he preferred the written word."
"He doesn't seem to have written much here. When did he switch?"
"On Lesbos. On holiday. He's not writing it yet. He's preparing."
"Oh."
He began another page.
"He calls it a matrix."
"Does he, though?" Still reading. "I must show some of this to Beau. He's a literary man."
"And when we retire, when he does, if he takes early retirement, he'll write. I'll paint and bookbind. That's the plan."
Brotherhood turned a page.
"In Dorset?"
"At Plush, yes."
"Well, he's taken early retirement, all right," he remarked, not very nicely, as he resumed his reading. "Wasn't the sculpture, too, at some point?"
"It wasn't practical."
"I shouldn't think it was."
"You encourage those things, Jack. The firm does. You're always saying we should have hobbies and recreations."
"What's the book about, then? Anything special?"
"He's still finding the line. He likes to keep it to himself."
"Listen to this. When the most horrible gloom was over the household, when Edward himself was in agony and behaving as prettily as he knew how..." "Well, not even a main verb, as far as I can make out."
"He didn't write that."
"It's in his handwriting, Mary."
"It's from something he read. When he reads a book, he underlines things in pencil. Then when he's finished it, he writes out his favourite bits."
From upstairs she heard a sharp snap,
like the cracking of timber or the firing of a pistol back in the days when she had been taught.
"That's Tom's room," she said. "They don't need to go in there."
"Get me a bag, dear," Brotherhood said. "A bin bag will do. Will you find me one?" She went to the kitchen.
"Why do I let him do this to me? Why do I let him march into my house, my marriage and my mind, and help himself to everything he doesn't like?"
Mary was not usually compliant. Tradesmen did not rob her twice. In the English school, the English church, in the Diplomatic Wives Association, she was regarded as quite the little shrew. Yet one hard stare of Jack Brotherhood's pale eyes, one growl of his rich, careless voice was enough to send her running to him.
"It's because he's so like Daddy," she decided. "He loves our kind of England, and the rest can go hang. It's because I worked for Jack in Berlin when I was an empty-headed schoolgirl with one small talent. Jack was my older lover at a time when I thought I needed one. It's because he steered Magnus through his divorce for me when he was dithering and gave him to me for afters, as he called it. It's because he loves Magnus too."
Brotherhood was flipping the pages of her desk diary. "Who's P?" he demanded, tapping a page. 25th September, 6:30, P. There's a P on the 16th too, Mary. That's not P for Pim, is it? Or am I being stupid again? Who's this P he's meeting?"
She began to hear the scream inside herself and had no whiskey left to quell it. "Of all the entries, the dozens and dozens, and he has to pick that one. I don't know. A Joe, I don't know.
You wrote it, didn't you?"
"Magnus asked me to. Put down I'm meeting P. He didn't keep a diary of his own. He said it was insecure."
"And he made you write the entries for him?"
"He said if anybody looked, they wouldn't know which were his dates and which were mine. It was part of sharing."
She felt Brotherhood's stare. "He's making me speak," she thought. "He wants to hear the quaver in my voice."
"Sharing what?"
"His work."
"Explain."
"He couldn't tell me what he was doing, but he could show me that he was doing it and when."
"Did he say that?"
"I could feel it."
"What could you feel?"
"That he was proud. He wanted me to know."
"Know what?"
Brotherhood could drive her mad even when she knew he meant to.
"Know that he had another life, an important one, that he was being used."
"By us?"
"By you, Jack, by the firm. Who do you think, the Americans?"
"Why did you say that? The Americans? Did he ever sing about them?"
"Why should he? He served in Washington."
"Needn't stop him. Might even encourage him. Did you know the Lederers in Washington?"
"Of course we did."
"But better here, eh? I hear she's quite an armful."
He was turning forward to the days yet to be endured, tomorrow and the day after, to the weekend, which was already gaping at her like a hole in her shattered universe.
"Mind if I keep this?" he asked.
Mary Damwell did mind. She possessed no spare diary and no spare life either. She snatched it back and let him wait while she copied out her future on a sheet of paper.
"Drinks, Lederers, dinner, Dinkles, Tom's school term ends."
She came to 6:30 p.m., P, and left it out.
"Why is this drawer empty?" he asked.
"I didn't know it was."
"So, what was it full of?"
"Old photographs, mementos, nothing."
"How long's it been empty?"
"I don't know, Jack, I don't know. Get off my back, will you?"
"Did he put papers in his suitcase?"
"I didn't watch him pack."
"Did you hear him down here while he was packing?"
"Yes."
The telephone rang.
Mary's hand shot out to take it, but Brotherhood was already grasping her wrist. Still holding her, he leaned towards the door and yelled for Harry while the phone went on ringing. It was rising 4 a.m. already.
Who the hell calls at 4 in the morning except Magnus?
Inside herself, Mary was praying so loud she hardly heard Brotherhood's shout. The phone kept calling her, and she knew now that nothing mattered except Magnus and her family.
"It might be Tom!" she shouted while she struggled. "Let go, damn you!"
"It might be Lederer, too."
Harry must have flown downstairs. She counted two more rings before he was standing in the doorway.
"Trig this call," Brotherhood ordered, loud and slow.
Harry vanished. Brotherhood released Mary's hand.
Make it very, very long, Mary. Spread it right out. You know how to play those games. Do it.
She lifted the phone and said, Pym Residence?
Nobody answered.
Brotherhood was conducting her with his powerful hands, willing her, pressing her to talk. She heard a metallic ping and crammed her hand over the mouthpiece.
It could be a call code, she breathed.
She held up one finger for one ping, then a second, then a third. It was a call code. They had used them in Berlin. Two for this, three for that. Private and prearranged between the Joe and base. She opened her eyes to Brotherhood to say, What shall I do? He shook his head to say, I don't know either.
Speak, he mouthed.
Mary drew a deep breath.
Hello? Speak up, please.
She took refuge in German.
This is the residence of Councillor Magnus Pym of the British Embassy.
Who is that? Will you speak, please?
Mr. Pym is not here at the moment. If you wish to leave a message, you may do so. Otherwise, please call later.
Hello? More, Brotherhood was urging. Give me more. She recited her telephone number in German, and again in English. The line was open, and she could hear a noise like traffic, and a noise like scratchy music played at half speed, but no more pings. She repeated the number in English.
Speak up, please. The line is dreadful. Hello? Can you hear me? Who's that calling, please? Do, please, speak up.
Then she couldn't help herself. Her eyes closed and she screamed,
Magnus, for God's sake, say where you are.
But Brotherhood was miles ahead of her. With a lover's knowledge, he had felt her outburst coming and clapped his hand over the cradle.
Too short, sir, Harry lamented from the doorway. I'd need another minute at the least.
Was it foreign? Brotherhood said.
Could be foreign, could be next door, sir.
That was naughty, Mary. Don't do those things again. We're on the same side in this, and I'm boss.
Someone's kidnapped him, she said. I know they have.
Everything froze. Herself, his pale eyes, even Harry in the doorway.
Well, well, said Brotherhood at last. That would make you feel better, would it, a kidnapping?
Now, why do you say that, dear? What's worse than kidnapping, I wonder?
Trying to meet his gaze, Mary experienced a violent time warp.
I don't know anything. I want plush. Give me back the land that Sam and Daddy died for.
She saw herself as a school leaver, seated in front of the careers mistress in the middle of her last term. A second woman is with her, London and tough.
This lady is a recruiting officer for the Foreign Service, dear, says the careers mistress.
A special bit of it, says the tough woman.
She's terribly impressed by the way you draw, dear, says the careers mistress. She so admires your draftsmanship, as we all do. She wonders whether you'd be interested in taking your folder to London for a day or two, so that some other people can look at it.
It's for your country, dear, the tough woman says, with meaning, to the child of English patriots.
She remembered the training house in East Anglia, girls like herself, our class. She remembered the jolly lessons in copying and engraving and colouring, in papers and cardboards and linens and threads, how to make watermarks and how to alter them, how to cut rubber stamps, how to make paper look older and how to make it look younger. And she tried to remember just when it was exactly that they had realised they were being taught to forge documents for British spies. And she saw herself standing before Jack Brotherhood in his rickety upstairs office in Berlin, not a stone's throw from the wall, Jack the Stripper, Jack the Stoat, Jack the Black, and all the other Jacks he was known as. Jack, who had charge of Berlin Station, and liked to meet all newcomers personally, particularly if they were pretty girls of 20. She remembered his bleached gaze running slowly over her body while he guessed her shape and sexual weight, and she remembered again hating him on sight, as she was trying to hate him now, as she watched him flip through a folder of family correspondence he had pulled from the desk.
You realise half of those are Tom's letters from boarding school, I suppose, she said.
Why doesn't he write to both of you?
He does write to both of us, Jack. Tom and I have one correspondence,
Magnus and Tom have a separate correspondence.
No interconsciousness, said Brotherhood, using a bit of trade talk he had taught her in Berlin. He lit one of his fat yellow cigarettes and watched her theatrically through the flame.
There's a poseur in all of them, she thought, Magnus and Grant included.
You're absurd, she said, in nervous anger. It's an absurd situation, and Nigel will be here any minute to make it more absurd still. What caused it?
He opened another drawer.
His father, if it's a situation at all. Whose camera is this?
Tom's, but we all use it.
Any other cameras around?
No. If Magnus needs one for his work, he brings it from the embassy.
Any here from the embassy now?
No.
Maybe his father caused it, or maybe a lot of things did. Maybe a marital tiff I don't know about caused it.
He was examining the camera's settings, turning it over in his big hands, as if he were thinking of buying it.
We don't have them, she said.
His knowing eyes lifted to her.
How do you manage that?
He doesn't offer a fight, that's why.
You do, though. You're a right little demon when you get going, Mary.
Not any more, she said, mistrusting his charm.
You never met his dad, did you? Said Brotherhood, as he wound the film through the camera. It was something about him, I seem to remember.
They were estranged.
Ah, nothing dramatic. They drifted apart. They're that sort of family.
What sort, dear?
Scattered business people. He'd said he'd let them in on his first marriage, and once was enough. We hardly talked about it.
Tom go along with that?
Tom's a child. Tom was the last person Magnus saw before he vanished, Mary, apart from the porter at his club.
So arrest him, Mary suggested rudely.
Dropping the film into the bin bag, Brotherhood picked up Magnus's little transistor radio.
This the new one they do with all the shortwave on it?
I believe so.
Take it with him on holiday, did he?
Yes, he did.
Listen to it regularly.
Since, as you once told me, he runs Czechoslovakia single-handed out here, it would be fairly startling if he didn't.
He switched it on. A male voice was reading the news in Czech. Brotherhood stared blankly at the wall while he let it continue for what seemed like hours. He switched off the radio and put it in the bag. His gaze moved to the uncurtained window, but it was still a long while before he spoke.
Not displaying too many lights for the time of morning, are we, Mary? He asked, distractedly. Don't want to set neighbours chattering, do we?
They know Rick's dead. They know it's not a normal time.
You can say that again.
I hate him. I always did, even when I fell for him. When he was taking me up and down the scale and I was weeping and thanking him, I still hated him. Tell me about the night in question, he was saying. He meant the night they heard of Rick's death.
So she told him exactly as she had rehearsed it. He had found the cloakroom and was standing before the worn duffel coat, which hung between Tom's loden and Mary's sheepskin. He was feeling in the pockets. The din from upstairs was monotonous. He extracted a grimy handkerchief and a half-consumed roll of polo mints.
You're teasing me, he said.
All right, I'm teasing you.
2 hours in the freezing snow and his dancing pumps, Mary, in the middle of the night. Brother Nigel will think I'm making it up.
What did he do in them?
Walked.
Where to, dear?
He didn't tell me.
Ask him?
No, I didn't.
Then how do you know he didn't take a cab?
He'd no money. His wallet and chains were upstairs in the dressing room with his keys.
Brotherhood replaced the handkerchief and mints in the duffel.
And none in here?
No.
How do you know?
He's methodical in those things.
Maybe he paid the other end?
No.
Maybe someone picked him up?
No.
Why not?
He's a walker and he was in shock, that's why.
His father was dead, even if he didn't particularly like him.
It builds up in him, the tension or whatever it is. So he walks.
And I hugged him when he came back, she thought. I felt the cold on his cheek and the trembling of his chest,
and the hot sweat clean through his coat from his hours of walking. And I'll hug him again as soon as he comes through that door. I said to him, "Don't go, not tonight. Get drunk, we'll get drunk together." But he went, he had his look. She wished she hadn't said that, but for a moment she was as cross with Magnus as she was with Brotherhood. "What look is that, Mary?" "Had his look. I don't think I follow you." "Empty, like an actor without a part." "A part? His father takes up and dies and Magnus doesn't have a part anymore. What the hell does that mean?" "He's closing in on me," she thought, resolutely not answering. "In a minute I'm going to feel his sure hands on me, and I'm going to lie back and let it happen, because I can't think of any more excuses." "Ask Grant," she said, trying to hurt him. "He's our tame psychologist. He'll know." They had moved to the drawing room. He was waiting for something. So was she. For Nigel, for Pym, for the telephone. For Georgie and Fergus upstairs. "You're not doing too much of this, are you?" Brotherhood asked, pouring her another whiskey. "Of course not. When I'm alone, almost never." "Well, don't. It's too damn easy. And when Brother Nigel's here, nothing. Keep it under wraps completely. Yes, Jack." "Yes, Jack. You're a lecherous priest scavenging the last of God's grace," she told him, watching his slow, purposeful movements as he filled his own glass. "First the wine, now the water. Now lower your eyelids and lift the chalice for a sanctimonious word with him who sent you."
"And he's free," he remarked. "I'm free. Rick's dead, so Magnus is free. He's one of your Freudian types who can't say father."
"It's perfectly normal at his age, to call a father by his Christian name. More normal still if you haven't seen each other for 15 years.
"I do like you to defend him," Brotherhood said. "I admire your loyalty. So will they. And you never let me down. I know you didn't."
Loyalty, she thought. "Keeping my silly mouth shut round the station in case your wife finds out."
"And you wept. Quite the old weeper you are, Mary. I didn't know." "Mary weeps. Magnus consoles her. Odd that, to the casual observer, seeing as how Rick was his daddy, not yours. A role reversal with a vengeance, that is. You doing his mourning for him. Who were the tears for, exactly? Any idea?"
"His father had died, Jack. I didn't sit down and say, 'I'll cry for Rick, I'll cry for Magnus.' I just cried."
"I thought it might be for yourself."
"What's that supposed to mean?"
"You're the one person you didn't mention, that's all. Defensive. That's how you sound."
"I am not being defensive."
She was too loud. She knew it. And once more so did Brotherhood, and he was interested. "And when Magnus is done with consoling Mary," he continued, picking a book from the table and flicking through it, "he slips on his duffel and he goes for a walk and his dancing pumps. You try to restrain him, you beg him, which is hard for me to visualize, but I'll try. But no, he will go." "Any phone calls before he leaves?"
"No."
"No incoming, no outgoing?"
"I said no."
"Direct dial, after all. You'd think a bereaved man would want to share the bad news with other members of his family."
"They're not that kind of family, I told you."
"There's Tom, for a start. What about him?"
It was much too late to ring Tom. And anyway, Magnus thought it better to tell him himself.
He was looking at the book. "Another gem," he's underlined. "If I am not for myself, who is for me? And being for my own self, what am I? If not now, when? Well, well, I'm enlightened. Are you?"
"No."
"Nor am I. He's free." He closed the book and put it back on the table. "He didn't take anything with him on his walk, did he? Like a briefcase?"
"A newspaper."
"You're going deaf. Admit it. You're worried that a hearing aid will spoil your self-image.
Speak, damn you." She had said it. She knew she had. She had been waiting all evening to say it. Prepared it from every possible angle. Practiced it, rehearsed it, denied it, forgotten it, revived it.
and now it was echoing in her head like an explosion while she took a frightfully careless pull at her whiskey. Yet his eyes, straight at her, were still waiting.
A newspaper, she repeated. Just a newspaper. What of it?
Which newspaper?
The Presser.
That's a daily.
Correct. D. Presser is a daily.
A local daily newspaper, and Magnus took it with him, to read in the dark, dressed in his dancing pumps. Tell me about it.
I just did, Jack.
No, you didn't. And you're going to have to, Mary, because when we get the heavy guns here, you're going to need all the help you can get. She had perfect recall.
Magnus was standing by the door, a step from where Brotherhood stood now. He was pale and untouchable, the duffel coat flung crookedly over his shoulders, while he glared round in stiff phases. Fireplace, wife, clock, books. She heard herself telling him the things she had already recounted to Brotherhood, but more of them.
For God's sake, Magnus, stay. Don't get the blacks. Stay. Don't sink into one of your moods. Stay, make love, get drunk. If you want company, I'll get Grant and Bee back, or we'll go there.
She saw him smile, his rigid, bright-lit smile. She heard him put on his awfully easy voice, his Lesbos voice. And she heard herself repeat his words exactly to Brotherhood now.
He said, Mabs, where's the bloody paper, darling? I thought he meant the Times for looking at the Scottish property market. So I said, wherever you put it when you brought it back from the embassy.
But he didn't mean the Times, said Brotherhood.
He went over to the rack. There.
She looked at it but didn't point, because she was terrified of giving too much importance to the gesture.
And helped himself to de presse from the rack, where the presser is kept, till the end of each week. He likes me to keep the back numbers.
Then he walked out, she ended, making it all sound perfectly normal, which of course it was. Did he look at it at all when he took it out?
Just the date, to check.
What did you suppose he wanted it for?
Maybe there was a late-night film.
Magnus had never gone to a late-night film in his life.
Maybe he wanted something to read in the cafe.
With no money on him, she thought, as she filled the void of Brotherhood's silence.
Maybe he was looking for a distraction, as we all might be, have been. Anyone might, when they're bereaved.
Or free, Brotherhood suggested, but he did not otherwise help her.
Anyway, he was so upset he took the wrong days, she said brightly, clinching the matter.
You looked, did you, dear?
Only when I was throwing away.
When were you doing that?
Yesterday.
Which one did you take?
Mondays. It was all of 3 days old, so I mean, obviously he was in considerable shock.
Obviously.
All right, his father wasn't the great love of his life, but he was still dead. Nobody's rational when a thing like that happens, not even Magnus.
So what did he do next, after he'd looked at the date and taken the wrong days?
He went out, as I told you, for a walk. You don't listen. You never did.
Did he fold it?
Really, Jack, what does it matter how somebody carries a newspaper?
Just tuck in your ego a minute and answer. What did he do with it?
Rolled it.
And then?
Nothing. He carried it in his hand.
Did he carry it back again?
Here to the house? No.
How do you know he didn't?
I was waiting for him in the hall.
And you noticed no newspaper, no rolled newspaper, you said to yourself.
Purely incidentally, yes.
Incidentally nothing, Mary. You had it in your mind to look. You knew he'd gone out with it, and you spotted at once he'd come back without it. That's not incidental, that's spying on him. Please yourself. He was angry. It's you who's going to have to do the pleasing, Mary, he said, loud and slow. You're going to have to please Brother Nigel in about 5 minutes from now. They're in spasm, Mary. They can see the ground opening up at their feet again, and they do not know what to do. They literally do not know what to do.
His anger passed. Jack could do that.
And later, as soon as you had a chance, you incidentally searched his pockets, and it wasn't there.
I didn't look for it, I simply noticed it was missing, and yes, it wasn't there.
Does he often go out with old newspapers?
When he needs to keep abreast for his work. He's a conscientious officer. He takes a newspaper with him.
Rolled up?
Sometimes.
Bring them back, ever?
Not that I remember.
Ever remark on it to him?
No.
He to you?
Jack, it's a habit he has. Look, I'm not going to have a marital row with you.
We're not married.
He rolls up a newspaper and walks with it, the way a child carries a stick or something. As a comforter or something, like his polos. There, he had polos in his pocket. It's the same thing.
Always the wrong date.
Not always. Don't make so much of everything.
And always loses it.
Jack, stop. Just stop, okay?
Does he do it on any special occasion? Full moon? Last Wednesday of the month? Or only when his father dies? Have you noticed a pattern to it? Go on, Mary, you have.
Beat me, she thought. Grab me. Anything is better than that ice-cold stare.
It's sometimes
when he meets P, she said,
trying to sound as if you were pacifying a spoilt child.
Jack, for God's sake, he runs Joe's. He lives that life. You trained him. I don't ask him what his tricks are, what he's doing with who. I'm trained too.
And when he came back, how was he?
He was absolutely fine. Calm. Completely calm. He'd walked it out of himself. I could feel. He was absolutely fine in every way.
No phone calls while he was out?
No.
None after?
One. Very late, but we didn't answer it.
It was not often she had seen Jack surprised. Now he almost was. You didn't answer it?
Why should we?
Why shouldn't you? It's his job, as you said. His father had just died. Why shouldn't you answer the phone?
Magnus said don't.
Why did he say don't?
We were making love,
she said, and felt like the worst whore ever. Harry was looming in the doorway again. He was wearing blue overalls and had a red face from his exertions. He was holding a long screwdriver in his hand, and he looked shamefully joyful. Care to pop upstairs a jiffy, Mr. Brotherhood? He said.
It's like our bedroom before the diplomatic wife's jumble sale, with our cast-off clothes all over the bed, she thought. Magnus, darling, do you really need 3 worn-out cardigans? Clothes over the chairs, over the dressing table and the towel horse. My summer blazer that I haven't worn since Berlin. Magnus's dinner jacket hung from the cheval mirror like a drying hide. There was nothing on the floor, because there was no floor. Fergus and Georgie had removed the carpet and most of the floorboards underneath it, and stacked them like sandwiches beneath the window, leaving the joist and the odd plank for a walkway. They had taken the bedside lamps to pieces, and the bedside furniture, and the telephone, and the wake-up wireless. In the bathroom it was the floor again, and the panel to the bath, and the medicine chest, and the sloped attic door that led to the sloped attic, where Tom had hidden for a whole half-hour last Christmas, playing murder, and nearly died of fright from being so brave. At the basin, Georgie was working her way through Mary's things, her face cream, her diaphragm.
"What's yours is his, for them, dear, and vice versa," said Brotherhood, as they paused to stare in from the doorless doorway. "There's no his and hers, not for them, there can't be."
"Not for you either," she said. Tom's bedroom was across the corridor from their own. His luminous Superman lay sprawled over the bed, together with his 31 Smurfs and 3 Tiggers. Her father's campaign table was folded against the wall. The toy chest had been pulled to the center of the floor, revealing the marble fireplace behind. It was a fine fireplace. Works department had wanted to board it over to reduce drafts, but Magnus hadn't let them. Instead, he had bought this old chest to put across the opening, leaving the mantel visible over it, so that Tom could have a bit of old Vienna all his own. Now the fireplace stood free, and the girl Georgie knelt respectfully before it in her 50-guinea freedom fighter's tunic. And before Georgie lay a white shoebox with its lid off, and inside the shoebox was a rag bundle, then several smaller bundles around it.
"We found it on the ledge up above the grate, sir," said Fergus, "where it joins the main flue."
"Not a speck of dust on it," said Georgie.
"Reach up and it's there," said Fergus.
Dead handy.
You don't even have to shove the chest out, really, once you get the knack, said Georgie.
Seen it before? Brotherhood asked.
It's obviously something of Tom's, said Mary. Children will hide anything.
Seen it before? Brotherhood repeated.
No.
Know what's in it?
How could I if I hadn't seen it?
Easily.
Brotherhood did not stoop, but held his arms out. Georgie passed the box up to him, and Brotherhood took it to the table where Tom did his spirograph and his Lego, and his endless drawings of German aeroplanes being shot down against a plush sunset, with family in the background, everybody waving, everybody absolutely fine. Brotherhood picked out the biggest bundle first, and they looked on while he started to unwrap it, and changed his mind.
Here, he said, handing it to Georgie. Woman's fingers.
She's one of his mistresses, Mary suddenly realized. She wondered why on earth it hadn't dawned on her before.
Georgie rose elegantly to her full height, one leg, other leg, and having fixed her straight hair behind her ears, applied her woman's fingers to unwinding the strips of bedsheet that Magnus had said he wanted for the car, revealing at last a small, clever-looking camera with a clever steel harness around it. And after the camera, a thing like a telescope with a bracket on it, which, when you pulled it to its full length, made a stand that you could screw the camera to, face downwards and at a fixed distance, for photographing documents on your father-in-law's campaign table. After the telescope came a succession of films and lenses and filters and rings and other bits of equipment she could not identify offhand, and underneath these, a pad of flimsy cloth paper with columns of numbers on the top sheet, and thickly rubberized edges so that you could only see the top page. Mary knew the type of paper. She had worked on it in Berlin. It shriveled into fern the moment you put a match near it. The pad was half used. Underneath the pad, again, an aged cardboard-backed military jotting pad marked WD Property, standing for War Department, and consisting of unwritten-on lined paper of blotchy wartime quality. And inside it, when Brotherhood continued searching, two pressed red flowers of great age. Poppies. But just possibly roses, she was not entirely certain. And anyway, by then she was shouting,
"It's for the firm! It's for his work for you!"
"Of course it is. I'll tell Nigel, no problem."
"Just because he didn't tell me about it, it doesn't mean it's wrong. It's for in case he gets landed with documents in the house at weekends."
And then realizing what she had said,
"It's for his Joes, if they bring him documents, you fool. If Grant does, and he's got to turn them round at short notice, what's so fucking sinister about that?"
Fergus was fingering the half-used pad, turning it over and over, tilting it in the beam of Tom's angle-poised lamp.
"Looks more like your check, sir, frankly," said Fergus, tilting the pad to the light. "It could be Russian, but I think Czech's more likely, frankly."
"Yes," he said pleasantly, as his eye caught some unexplained feature of the rubber edge.
"That's it, Czech. Mind you, that's only where they're made. Who's dishing them out is another matter, especially these days."
Brotherhood was more interested in the pressed flowers. He had laid them on his palm and was staring at them as if they told his future.
"I think you're a bad girl, Mary," he said deliberately. "I think you know a lot more than you told me. I don't think he's in Ireland or the bloody Bahamas. I think that was a lot of smoke. I think he's a bad man, and I'm wondering whether you're bad together."
All constraint left her. She screamed, "You shit!" and hit at him with her open hand, but he blocked her. He put an arm round her and swung her off the ground as if she had no legs left. He carted her across the corridor to Frau Bauer's bedroom, which was the only room that hadn't so far been ripped apart. He dumped her on the bed and whisked her shoes off, exactly as he used to in the squalid safe flat where he did his screwing. He rolled her into the eiderdown, making a straitjacket of it. Then he lay on her, grappling her into submission while Georgie and Fergus looked on. But somehow, amazingly, throughout all these antics and dramatics, Jack Brotherhood had still contrived to keep hold of the two pressed poppies in his left fist, and kept hold of them even when the doorbell went again. One long peal for authority.
Chapter 4. To be above the fray, Pym wrote to himself on a separate sheet of paper, a writer is king. He should look down with love upon his subject, even when the subject is himself. Life began with Lipsy, Tom, and Lipsy happened long before you came along, or anyone else did, and long before Pym was what the firm calls of marriageable age. Before Lipsy, all Pym remembered was an aimless trek through different coloured houses, and a lot of shouting. After her, everything seemed to flow in one unstoppable direction, and all he had to do was sit in his boat and let the current carry him. From Lipsy to Poppy, from Rick to Jack, it was all one jolly stream, however much it wriggled and divided itself along the way. And not only life, but death began with her as well, for it was actually Lipsy's dead body that got Pym going, though he never saw it. Others saw it, and Pym could have made the journey, because it was in the bell yard, and no one covered it for ages. But the little fellow was going through a squeamish and self-centred period at the time, and had a notion that if he didn't see it, she might not be dead after all, but pretending. Or that her death was a judgment upon himself for taking part in the recent killing of a squirrel in the empty swimming pool. The hunt had been led by a wall-eyed maths master called Corbo the Crow. When the squirrel was safely trapped, Corbo sent three boys down the pool ladder with hockey sticks, and Pym was one.
On you go, Pimmy, give it to him, Corbo urged.
Pym had watched the crippled creature limp towards him. Scared by its pain, he had caught it a great swipe, harder than he meant. He had seen it catapult to the next player and lie still.
Good man, Pimmy, good shot. Do it to the Huns next time.
His other thought was that the Sefton Boyd gang had made the whole thing up to tease him, always possible. So as a stopgap, Pym gave himself the desk job of gathering descriptions and forming, in that first rush before the school went silent, a mind's picture of her that was probably as clear as anybody's. She lay in a running position, sideways on the flagstones, her forward hand punched towards the finishing line and her rear foot pointing the wrong way. Sefton Boyd, who made the original sighting and alerted the headmaster during school breakfast, actually thought she was running, he said, until he saw the wonky foot. He thought she was doing a special exercise on her side, a sort of kicking, bicycling exercise. And he thought the blood round her was a cape or a towel that she was lying on, until he noticed how the old chestnut leaves stuck to it and wouldn't blow away. He didn't go close, because Bellyard was out of bounds, even to sixth-formers, on account of the dangerous roof above it. And he didn't throw up, he boasted, because us Sefton Boyds own simply masses of land, and I've done a lot of shooting with my father, and I'm accustomed to seeing blood and innards all the time. But he did run up sixth-form staircase to the tower window, which the police said later was where she had fallen from. She must have been leaning out to do something. And it must have been something urgent and important she was leaning out for, because she had been wearing her nightdress, having bicycled up the mile-long drive from the overflow house in the middle of the night. Her bicycle with its tartan cover on the saddle was still leaning against the dustbin shed behind the kitchens. Sefton Boyd's theory, excitedly culled from his father's lifestyle, was that she was drunk, except that he didn't call her she, but Shitlips, which was his gang's witty play on lipshits. But then again, as he had been suggesting for some time, Shitlips may have been a German spy who had slipped up the tower to send messages after blackout, sir. Because from tower window, you can see right the way across the valley to the brace of partridges. So it would be a wizard place for signalling to German bombers, sir. The trouble was, she had no light with her except her bike lamp, which was still securely on the handlebars. So perhaps she had hidden it in her vagina, which Sefton Boyd claimed to have seen clearly, because the fall had ripped her nightdress off. Thus the stories went round that morning, while Pym stood on the fine wood seat of the staff lavatory, which he had made his safe house after the first furore, and held his breath, and blushed, and turned white in front of the mirror, in a series of puzzled efforts to make his face appropriate to his grief. Using the Swiss Army penknife from his pocket, he had sawn off a bit of his forelock, as a sort of useless tribute, then loitered, fiddling with the taps, and hoping everyone was looking for him. Where's Pym? Pym's run away. Pym's dead too. But Pym hadn't run away, nor was he dead. And in the chaos of having Lipsy's body lying in Bell Yard, an ambulance and police arriving, nobody was looking for anybody, least of all in the staff lavatory, which was the most out-of-bounds place in the school, so forbidden that Sefton Boyd himself was in awe of it. Classes were cancelled, and what you were supposed to do after all the shouting and the clamour was go quietly to your form room and revise. Unless, like Pym, you were in the second form which overlooked Bell Yard, in which case you were to go to the Arts Hall. This was the converted Nissen hut built by Canadian soldiers, where Lipsy taught music and painting and drama, and held remedial exercises for boys with flat feet. It was also where she did her typing and paperwork in her capacity as school dog's body, collecting school fees, paying school bills for the bursar, ordering taxis for boys in confirmation class, and, as such people do, just about running the place single-handed and unthanked. But Pym wouldn't go to the Arts Hall either, though he had a half-finished balsa model of a Dornier to work on with his penknife, as well as a half-made plan to copy out some obscure poems from an old book there and claim they were his own. What he had to do, when he found his courage and the moment, was get back to the Overflow House where he had lived till now with Lipsy and the 11 other Overflow boys. Until he had done that, and done something about the letters, he didn't go anywhere, because Rick would go back to prison. How he had got himself into this pass, how he had acquired the training that was to stand him in such fine stead in this, his first clandestine operation, was pretty much the story of his life this far, which was 10 years and 3 terms of boarding school old. Even today, trying to trace Lipsy through Pym's life is like pursuing an errant light through an impenetrable thicket. For Purse Loft, now dead himself, she was simply deniable. Titch's figment, he called her, meaning my invention, my fabrication, my nothing. But Purse, the great lawyer, could have made a figment out of the Eiffel Tower after he had banged his nose on it, if he needed to. That was his job. And this, despite the testimony of Sid and others that it was Purse himself who first had the use of her. Purse who had introduced her to the court back in the dark ages before Pym's birth. Mr. Muspole, that marvel with the books, also now passed on, understandably backed Purse up. He would. He was up to his neck in the business himself. Even Sid, the one surviving source, is not much more helpful.
She was a German 4x2, he said,
using the affectionate Cockney rhyming slang for Jew. He thought she came from Munich. Could have been Vienna. She was lonely, Titch. Adored the kids. Adored you. He didn't say she adored Rick, but in the court that was taken for granted. She was a lovely, and in court ethic that was what lovelies were there for, to be seen right by Rick, and to bathe in his glory. And Rick, in his goodness, had her learn secretarial and qualify, says Sid. And your Dorothy, she thought the world of Lipsy and taught her English, which was meant, says Sid. After which he clams up, remarking only that it was a shame, and we should all learn from it. And maybe your dad worked her a bit too hard because she never had your advantages. Yes, he admits, she was a looker, and she had a drop of class to her which some of the others, let's face it, didn't always have, Titch. And she loved a joke, till she started to think of her poor family, and what had been done to them by those Jerrys. My furtive record checks have not been more enlightening. Finding myself with a run of registry during a stint as night duty officer, not too many years back, I chased Lipschitz, first name Annie, right through the general index, but drew a blank on all spellings. Old Dinkel in Vienna, who heads up the personnel side of the Austrian service, recently ran a similar search for me when I spun him a story. So on another occasion did his German counterpart in Cologne. Both reported no trace. In my memory, however, she is anything but no trace. She is a tall, soft-haired, vital girl with large, scared eyes and an air of flounce about her stride, nothing happening slowly. And I remember, it must have been a summer holiday in some house where we were temporarily sheltering. I remember how Pym longed more than anything to see her naked, and devoted his waking hours to contriving it. Which Lipsy must have guessed somehow, For one afternoon, she suggested he share her bath with her to save hot water. She even measured the water with her hand. Patriots were allowed 5 inches, and Lipsy was never less than a patriot. She stooped, naked, and let me watch her while she put her hand span in the tub, I'm sure she did, and brought it out again. "See, Magnus?" showing me the wet, spread hand. "Now we may be sure we do not help the Germans." Or so I fervently believe, though try as I may, I cannot to this day remember what she looked like. And I know that in the same house, or one like it, her room was opposite to Pym's own, across a corridor, and that it contained her cardboard suitcase, and photographs of her bearded brother and solemn sisters, in black hats and silver frames, that stood like tiny polished gravestones on her dressing table. And there was the room where she screamed at Rick, and warned him she would rather die than be a thief, and where Rick laughed his brown, rich laugh, the one that went on longer than it needed, and made everything all right again, until the next time. And though I do not remember a single lesson, she must have taught Pym German, because years later, when he came to learn the language formally, he discovered that he possessed a repository of information about her. "Aaron war mein Bruder, mein Vater war Architekt," all in the same past tense to which she herself by then belonged. He also realized, still later in life, that when she had called him her Mönchlein, she had meant her little monk, and was referring to the hard path of Martin Luther, "Little monk, go your own way." Whereas at the time he had thought she had cast him as the organ grinder's tethered monkey, and Rick as his organ grinder. The discovery raised his self-respect no end, until he realized she had been telling him that he must get along without her. And I know she was in paradise with us, because without Lipsy, there was no paradise. Paradise was a golden land between Gerard's Cross and the sea, where Dorothy wore an Angora pullover for her ironing and a blue ulster for her shopping. Paradise was where Rick and Dorothy fled after their runaway marriage, a metro land of new beginnings and exciting futures. But I don't remember a day of it without Lipsy flouncing somewhere at the edge, or telling me what was right and wrong in a voice I didn't mind. 1 hour eastward by Bentley motor car lay town, and in town lay the West End, and that was where Rick had his office. The office had a big, tinted photograph of Grandad T.P. wearing his mare's necklace, and the office was what kept Rick late at night, which was the infant Pym's best thing, because he was allowed to climb into Dorothy's bed and keep her warm. She was so small and shivery, even to a child. Sometimes Lipsy stayed behind with us. Sometimes she went to London with Rick, because she had to qualify, and, as I now understand, justify her survival when so many of her kind were dead. Paradise was a string of shiny racehorses that Sid called Never Wazzers, and a succession of even shinier Bentleys, which, like the houses, wore out as fast as the credit they were bought on, and had to be changed with thrilling rapidity for yet newer and more expensive models. Sometimes the Bentleys were so precious they had actually to be driven round the side of the house and hidden in the back garden, for fear they might become tarnished by the gaze of the unfaithful. At other times, Pym drove them at 1,000 miles an hour, sitting on Rick's lap, down sandy, unmade roads lined with cement mixers, hammering the big, deep horn at the builders while Rick shouted, "How are you, boys?" and invited them all back to the house for a glass of bubbly. And Lipsy was there beside us in the passenger seat, straight as a coachman and as distant, until Rick chose to speak to her or make a joke. Then her smile was like holiday sunshine, and she loved us both. Paradise was also St. Moritz, where Swiss Army penknives came from, though somehow the Bentleys and those 2 pre-war winters in Switzerland become fused in my memory as one place. Even today, I have only to sniff the leather interior of a grand car, and I am wafted willingly away to the great hotel drawing rooms of St. Moritz in the wake of Rick's riotous lover festival. The Kulm, the Suvretta House, the Grand. Pym knew them as a single gigantic palace, with different sets of servants, but always the same court. Rick's private household of jesters, tumblers, counsellors, and jockeys. He barely went anywhere without them.